This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. On today's show, a look at racial intelligence training for police officers. But first, most of us today think of the Civil War in terms of clear and defined boundaries between the slave states of Kentucky and Missouri and the free states of Illinois, Indiana, Ohio, and Kansas. But in his latest book, University of Cincinnati Professor Christopher Phillips explores the more ambiguous and fluid cultures and attitudes of what are referred to as the middle border states during the Civil War era. The rivers ran backward. The Civil War and the remaking of the American middle border has been awarded multiple honors. And Dr. Christopher Phillips joins us this afternoon to discuss his book and life in the middle border states during the Civil War. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Chris, thank you for being here this afternoon.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
So what inspired you to write this book?
Well, my whole life, I guess. I'm a product of the Midwest, the rural Midwest in particular, but I was educated in the South. And one of the things that occurred to me when I was actually in graduate school was that I seemed to be the voice of the, of as one professor put it, the rural white America. And so whenever there was the question of farm country or what do the people outside the South think, I seemed to be the go-to voice. Of course, I don't have any license or insight into that any more than any other person does. But it was my first experience of being othered, that I was someone who had a different perspective and maybe it wasn't the pervasive perspective. And so I became the voice of the non-South. And then my first two jobs, including the one at UC, were on borders. One, the Kansas-Missouri border, and I was teaching in Kansas and learned very quickly the Civil War narrative there was alive and well, but in a very one-sided way. And yet I studied Missouri, and then when I got the job here, I realized that many of those pervasive tensions that continued well after the war and were present when I was living in Kansas in the attitude of Kansans towards Missourians really was mirrored here in the way that Ohioans think of people below the Ohio River and vice versa.
Well, when we talk about middle border states, what does that mean exactly?
Well, it's a complicated term because in many ways there are many borders. But there's also not just a north-south border, which is one that we very, very much are familiar with because of our understanding of the outcome of the Civil War. But there's also an east-west border, one that was particularly important in the 19th century as Americans moved westward. And those borders in many ways became a bullseye to some degree or crosshairs right here in this region. And so the middle border was a way of getting at this third narrative that not only of the war but how the war came, the antebellum period, and then how the war was reconciled. It wasn't a pure north-south understanding. It was a third narrative. It was a third experience that went on here, one that was surprising and one that in many ways tests our understandings of regions and of nation as we understand it today.
So why doesn't the middle border fit into this north-south narrative? I mean, what were they going through that was different?
Well, one thing that we can say is that the forces, I guess you could say, the northern changes or northern style changes that were being impressed upon Americans were resisted. Centralization, urbanization, cosmopolitanization, industrialization. This is not a place that embraced all of that, certainly not uniformly. In many ways, this is a place that was originally settled by what we would today call Southerners, people who came from slave states. This was a place that didn't have a neat, clean ending to slavery in the way that we commonly assume because of the Northwest Ordinance. This is a place where slavery lingered, a place where a state like Abraham Lincoln's adopted state of Illinois, where I was raised, slavery persisted in full form until 1850 when the Illinois Supreme Court, by a one-vote margin, outlawed it. And Lincoln was actually in the 1840s, late 1840s, took on a case to try to remand a fugitive slave to his master in Kentucky. And Lincoln was ridiculed for that by abolitionists in the North, particularly Wendell Phillips, no relative of mine, who called him the slave hound of Illinois. when he ran for president. Because this is a much murkier, a much muddier story here about slavery, about freedom, about the gray areas within, about people, about practices and cultures. This is a Western place that was multifarious, and it had many different peoples living here with different perceptions, and that the question of slavery and freedom was not as simple as just extending the Mason-Dixon line down the Ohio and Missouri rivers. It becomes something that has to be accomplished. It has to be won, and it's won with politics.
So this Western, this middle border region does not fit into that North-South narrative.
Not neatly. It does and it doesn't at the same time. Yes, were there abolitionists here that we commonly assume as kind of leading the Northern style march westward in America? Yeah, of course there were. But they were opposed. They were deeply reviled. The very first martyrdom, if you will, or assassination of an abolitionist occurred in Illinois, Elijah Lovejoy. I happened to grow up about 10 miles from his brother's homestead, a bona fide underground railroad site, the Owen Lovejoy homestead in Princeton, Illinois. There's no question that the abolitionist influence was here, but abolitionists were not welcomed. Even in a place like Cincinnati, being an abolitionist was very difficult. Yes, we have our wonderful narrative of the Stowes and the Beechers and Lane Seminary. Of course we do. But the Beechers and the Stowes talked often about how difficult it was to be an abolitionist in a place like Cincinnati. They were not welcomed.
So it sounds like the middle border was just a blend of a lot of different attitudes. I think the term that gets used is fluid attitudes.
Exactly.
So what were some of the issues, the big issues that these middle border, I guess you could say they're Western borders because they're bordering the Western part of the country, right?
Right.
What were some of the really big issues that they struggled with?
Right. I would argue, first of all, this was the West. For at the time of the Stowes and the Beechers living here in Cincinnati, this was very, very clearly the West because the nation had not moved as far westward as it had. And so this was a place that people believed the nation would ultimately become because of here. And so they were proud of that, deeply proud. The issues themselves, there were many issues. Issues of the extent of the National Guard, issues, by the way, that we still debate, we're debating currently, how large the national government should be, how much influence it had over the states, the idea of federal versus state sovereignty, the issue of federal assistance, economic and otherwise, through internal improvements, laws and the like. All of these things are contested at this point, and Westerners found themselves with a fairly conservative response to that, white Westerners in particular. They wanted a place that at once they could have independence and freedom, and they could determine their own futures. But they also want the assistance of a federal government that is increasingly distant, meaning geographically, that they need to accomplish the kinds of things economically and otherwise that are going to assure their bright futures, whether that be Indian removal, whether that mean the regulation of trade, whether that mean the dredging of rivers and the building of infrastructure, things that we debate today here in this river city, or the question of slavery and its future in the nation. And it was one that was not reconciled in the way that we commonly assume.
So is it fair to say that these middle border states were primarily what we call the Midwest today? Is that inaccurate? Accurate?
I think so, except what I found is that even the term Midwest has its own political weight, and there is a narrative there that comes from the outcome of the Civil War. The Midwest was not a place or a term that was used until the 20th century. It was preceded by another more ambiguous term, the Middle West, that I found was much more urban. The Midwest connotes a kind of a ruralism, a pastoralism, a small town America, you know, with high values and morality and that sort of thing, and good education and progressivism. Well, all of that was part of this contest for meaning after the war. And it also was, to some degree, a dissent. a dissent about against the things that were accomplished by the Northern style victory, such as the expansion of the federal government, the expansion of cities, increasing marginalization of rural people and of agricultural lifestyles. These are things that people push back against that find themselves occasionally flaring in populist moments, such as the one we're in right now, that we've seen several times, generally with its epicenter not just in the Midwest but also in the South. And so Southerners and Midwesterners have this instinctual language, a language that helps them in many ways to understand or to interpret the changing the changes around them and the nature of the United States.
So was there an effort initially for these middle border states to be neutral in nature? Did they try to take a neutral stance?
This is one of the fascinating aspects of this story, is that we have – not all states felt that way when the war started, the Civil War started. But a number of them did, and they tended to be slave states. Slave states like Missouri and Kentucky and Maryland and even Delaware, the one, you know, the slave state we forget about, all of them found themselves unable to fully embrace the war as it came because they distrusted Lincoln, Abraham Lincoln, and the Republican Party, which was brand new. They felt that despite their best despite what they claimed, the Republicans, that they really had no intention to do anything about slavery where it existed, but they wanted to stop slavery's spread. That was the company line with the Republican Party, particularly among Western Republicans. A number of those states and people in those states didn't believe it. And they didn't want to fully embrace the Republican ascendance. And so in the initial months of the war, many of these states found themselves either – and their legislatures or their conventions – unable to send troops, for example, or they officially declared themselves neutral. They were – such as Kentucky. Kentucky actually made a very curious stipulation that they would go with the side that didn't send troops first. Meaning that if the Confederates invaded Kentucky first, Kentucky would side with the Union. Of course, it was a Union state, and that's exactly how Lincoln and many of the federal commanders interpreted it. And of course, the Confederates did invade first, and so Kentucky threw its weight behind the federal government. But it was always a distrustful weight, and they found themselves an uncomfortable partner. And a very divided state, as were those other states as well.
Is that why many today, it seems like, don't consider Kentucky to be part of the South?
Well, Kentucky has an interesting legacy, sort of wanting their cake and eating it too. They want to be part of the Southeastern Conference, and they are very happy to have something like 10 times the number of Confederate monuments than Union monuments during that war that are in the state itself. But at the same time, other Southerners and I was educated in Georgia, so I know this for a fact, and I was doing research in Kentucky for the book, and an editorial came out that Kentucky really wasn't the South. It just didn't have all of those things that Southerners understood about their own culture. Well, they had some of them, but not all of them, weather and foliage and magnolias and that sort of thing. And I found that interesting. And where was this person who wrote the editorial from? Athens, Georgia, where I was a graduate student. And I found the same thing, by the way, for many years out in Missouri, where people would come from the deeper South states, and they would say Missouri isn't Southern. But its politics in the aftermath of the war and the politics that exerted themselves during the war were deeply Southernized. And that's a term that I use in the book. They Southernized. In other words, they accepted and embraced to some degree, dependent upon their political perspectives, Missourians, Kentuckians, Delawareans, Marylanders, they accepted, dependent upon their view of the war and of the federal government and its war-making capacity, they tended to embrace in a kind of a dissenting way those aspects of Southern culture that they agreed with and they wanted to protect, and none was more important than slavery in the 19th century.
We will continue our conversation about the Civil War and the remaking of the American middle border. You can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney, and my guest this afternoon is UC Professor Christopher Phillips. His new book is The Rivers Ran Backward, The Civil War and the Remaking of the American Middle Border. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Chris, I have to ask you about the title, The Rivers Ran Backward. Can you explain that to us?
It's metaphoric to some degree. There's some historical reality there because the actual term the river ran backward points directly to the famous New Madrid earthquakes in 1810, 1811, 1812, where the Mississippi River did, after one particularly violent shock, one that was heard in Cincinnati, the bells were ringing here, and they even heard it and felt it in Washington, D.C. The Mississippi River did run backwards. But in the broader sense, what I found is that the war, and particularly after the war, there was a very, very different narrative that was embraced that in many ways took these places, whether they be north of the river, south of the river, away from that former east-west boundary and understanding and toward a more north-south one. And in doing that, they had to actually appropriate counter-narratives. And some of those narratives didn't square with the facts, such as Kentucky becomes very – in fact, it becomes – Kentucky, Missouri became the places where the lost cause were invented and then spread from there, in large part because of the contested nature of these states. These are places that sent people to the Confederacy or soldiers to the Confederacy and officers, but the majority of them actually fought for the Union. In Missouri, a wide majority fought for the Union. The story that was less recognized was the contested nature of the war on this side of the river. Ohio, Illinois, Indiana were also the epicenter of these war dissenters known as Copperheads. These are people who didn't agree with the Lincoln administration. They certainly didn't embrace emancipation as part of the war, and they continue to be a persistent problem, enough so that by 1864, Lincoln's convinced that these Copperheads will actually defeat him in these states. And there have been a number of ways of trying to neutralize them over the course of the year, the course of the war, and they never really go away. And so Lincoln, when he's running for re-election in 1864, he recognizes that this is a problem. And yet there's enough of a problem that Ohioans are happy to vote for, many of them, about a third of them, vote for a governor who was actually exiled from the state of Ohio, Clement Vallandigham of Dayton. Lincoln exiles him after he's arrested for giving an anti-war speech in Dayton at his home, and then he realizes he's got a problem. And so rather than hold him in prison, he releases him to the Confederacy. He leaves the Confederacy and he goes to Canada and he runs in absentia for governor in 1863 in Ohio. And he does really well because there are that many people that are angry with the Republican leadership and they want something very different. And yet when the war is over, that narrative almost entirely evaporates. There is no real story of dissent in these states, other than sort of an obligatory reference to it in a book or a lecture or something. And yet this is a place that was deeply, deeply divided. And Lincoln actually lost votes in these states between 1860 and 1864. And then they, in many ways, in order to appropriate the correct war narrative by those who supported the federal cause, the Copperheads are vilified and they are attacked and their narrative is effectively suppressed. At the end of the war, they don't exist. Scholars like me realize that that doesn't tell a very accurate picture because in these communities, all of these communities throughout this region, there are deep, deep divisions that manifest themselves during the war, manifest them by violence, manifest themselves by fractious politics, manifest themselves by strong arm tactics, manifest themselves by people from Ohio actually going across and enlisting in Confederate armies and units. These are stories that don't get told, and as well as people having their property confiscated for it. These stories don't get told on this side of the river, and on the other side of the river, the story that that held sway was that Kentucky was a Confederate state. Well, it did become one, but that wouldn't happen until about 1925.
Now, didn't also Ohio and Indiana and Illinois, didn't they have what were called black codes in effect in those states?
Right. One of the most interesting books I read in graduate school was a book called North of South, And it was written by a historian named Leon Letwack. And he found that segregation was well established in stories. North of slavery. Segregation was well established in cities like Cincinnati well before the Civil War. Segregation was really appropriated by Southerners after the war, and it really didn't occur until the 1890s. Northern, using air quotation marks, northern cities like Cincinnati had these things established for a very long time. Black codes were part of life here for the entire antebellum and 19th century experiences in all of these states where racial subordination was by law, and black codes were ways of doing that. It also was a place that didn't welcome African Americans. It was well known on the north side of the river that the West was the quote-unquote white man's country, and they wanted to make sure of that in many ways by having these very restrictive codes and laws. And they were all a jumble of them in all of these states, and it kept African Americans from being welcomed, and it also kept many of them from leaving slavery to move there. It's one of the reasons why slaves would, among many, would actually leave these states when they left if they ran from slavery, and they would get all the way to Canada before they felt free and they felt that they were safe.
Well, what would you say was the most surprising, interesting thing that you discovered as you were doing the research for this book, Chris?
There were many. It's really hard to say just one thing that was surprising. One of the things I think that was probably the most revelatory for me were the depths to which cultural politics were used to create a narrative of these states that people, depending upon what side that they were on, went to try and appropriate a narrative that they that conformed to their beliefs. And that will result in many ways in the belief system among many Ohioans that this was a place that was all for the Union, solid for the Union, even one that Lincoln said in 1864, saved the Union for the nation, meaning Ohio went for him. And yet, Ohio sends as one of its first two statutes to Congress, to Statuary Hall, it sent an obscure politician today none of us know about, William Allen, who was an anti-Lincoln, anti-emancipation Democrat. Ohio chose that person in part because the politics of that moment were such that Ohio was rejecting the 14th Amendment after initially ratifying it, and then it rejected the 15th Amendment. These are the well-known Reconstruction Amendments that gave African Americans citizenship. And Allen was a perfect representative of that because in many ways during the war he had foretold that this is where the nation would go if we reelect Abraham Lincoln.
So what do you think has been the long-term impact?
I think there are a number of them. Probably the most well-known would be how we look at one another dependent upon which culture and which narrative of the war was told in our families. Harry Truman's a great example of this because Truman was raised in Independence, Missouri. My grandmother, for example, absolutely thought he was the greatest man that had ever lived, the greatest president, certainly, because he was a common Midwesterner, as she said to me often. He believed in us and he knew us. He was one of us. But Harry Truman saw himself as a Southerner his entire life because he had been told the story of burying the family silver to keep it away from Kansas Jayhawkers and depredations by federal troops on their land and on their property and their slaves running away. These are the narratives that he learned. And so he never considered himself to be a Midwesterner. He considered himself to be a Southerner. That really is the legacy. If we consider ourselves to be Northerners, Southerners, or more contestedly Midwesterners, and Midwesternness was kind of a response in many ways, a middle response. We're not really Southerners because we didn't have slavery. That's the narrative. And we didn't fight against the Union. But we didn't really want to accept all of those things that came with it, including emancipation. So we're not really Northerners. So we Midwesterners had this middle ground, and we always have this middle ground as a check against these antagonistic forces, regional forces in America. Being a Midwesterner is kind of saying, I'm not of any of you because we're more practical and we're less didactic. We're pragmatic people. But it's also a legacy of dissent, meaning that that is also a voice that the Copperheads were raising, an objection that ironically in our modern politics we see flaring with populist revolts. that come out of this region. And then turn elections like 2016 into something completely unpredictable and came out particularly from this region. One of the great I do this with students. I'll show the red-blue state maps from the elections of 2008, 2012, and 2016. And the thing that strikes them the most is how the South and Midwest and the Great Plains honed together as red states increasingly to the point that in 2016 you're even pulling Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan into that. That really is that populist voice that feels that in many ways today – their needs are not being considered by the powers that be.
513-419-7100 is our number, and Drake joins us now. Hi, Drake.
Oh.
Go right ahead.
Yes. Hey, first of all, thank you for writing the book and for this program. I'm interested to know from your guest, what does he hope the impact of this research, the book, and any other subsequent material that comes from it will have on the current and future politics and life in our country, considering the racial tensions and all the upheaval we have currently?
That's a really wonderful question, and it's also a complicated one. It isn't so much what I hope to accomplish. It sort of was telling a story that I think that is in our midst that we have effectively ignored, and that is that there is a great middle in this United States whose voice doesn't easily get heard and told, and that harkens back to a very, very divisive war that we experienced that is told in a binary narrative. It's North versus South. And what we don't understand was that there is a messy middle in that story.
It was messy
It was messy before the war. It was messy during it, and it became even more messy after it. And that if we ignore those common voices in the middle, however we want to define that middle, geographically, racially, culturally, economically, if we ignore those voices, we are in many ways setting ourselves up to have a fully divided nation yet again, as brought on that war in the 1860s. Westerners at the time were doing everything they could to stay out of that conflict. And they said so again and again and again. They didn't manage to do it, but they managed to stave it off until the middle of that war when things really started to change. If we ignore that voice today, we will end up having surprising elections like we had in 2016 more often.
Chris, thanks for joining me today.
Very, very glad to be here.
UC professor Dr. Christopher Phillips, his new book is The Rivers Ran Backward, The Civil War and the Remaking of the American Middle Border. Coming up, we'll hear how police officers train to de-escalate dangerous situations and prevent encounters from turning deadly. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.